This is section one of content of the PDH online course in the 2005 National Electric Code. We will be discussing key changes and critical requirements of the 2005 National Electric Code. I will reference each of the articles for your reference should you choose to pursue it. And again, the exact wording of the code is at least as important as my interpretation. Hopefully my interpretation will be an indication to you that it's worth studying. There will be paraphrased requirements in ordinary English followed by discussion. For copyright reasons, we do not repeat word for word the National Electric Code, but that's really the purpose of the course also. National Electric Code is in a very formal, enforceable language. This course will be hopefully in something closer to ordinary English and hopefully have a little more personal interaction than you might get from following the actual National Electric Code. Requirement for a short circuit study. And there will be a lot of discussion on this. In fact, I'm currently working on a course for PDH Online to help you satisfy this requirement called Minimal Short Circuit Analysis. But the sections in the National Electric Code are 110.9 and 110.10, right at the beginning of the code. Protective equipment intended to interrupt fault currents shall have an interrupting rating sufficient. That is, the overcurrent protective device's total impedance component short circuit current rating shall be selected and coordinated to clear a fault without extensive damage. Now, the key to this is short circuit rating. You've got to know the short circuit available fault, and you get to specify the short circuit rating of your devices, and perhaps in worst case, change a fuse or install a fuse so that you have a little more short circuit rating than you had it before. As discussed previously, there's a narrative portion associated with this course, and we go into the first of the narrative sections called an optional narrative. There are many places in the code where it is clear that equipment selected must be capable of doing the intended job. For protective devices, opening a short circuit fault requires a higher rating than that of the fault available. To meet this code requirement, you must know the fault available. This is what you get from a short circuit study. There is no other way to get this value except from a short circuit study. More and more, owners and plans examiners are demanding to see the available short circuit currents. Selectivity and coordination are discussed in later sections. And to elaborate just a little bit on what is so current in my mind since I'm working on this other course, the three ways we'll examine in that course of determining the available short circuit are by manual calculations that anybody with a calculator and a lot of time can do. The second method, something called SKM. It's commercial software, very well regarded, and available for an evaluation copies to so that you can practice with it, perhaps even do a little bit to solve the immediate problem before purchasing the package. Third method is a software package called ETAP. It's a little different from SKM, a little better in some ways, probably has shortcomings in other ways. Present interpretations for the requirement for arc flash labeling, section 110.16. Field mark switchboards, panel boards, industrial control panels, meter socket enclosures, and motor control centers to warn of arc flash hazards. The label must be visible before examination, adjustment, servicing, or maintenance of equipment. Now, I try not to get into the nitpicking details of the code. My feeling is you read the code, you follow the code, you got no problems. There are people, and for I'm certain good reasons that I don't fully appreciate, who try to get the absolute minimal to satisfy the code. If you work for one of those people, you must notice that this only applies to switchboards, panel boards, industrial control panels, meter socket enclosures, and motor control centers. For instance, is a single motor starter one of these? It's arguable that it's not, and it doesn't require an arc flash label. Labels cost 10 cents. Hush. This is the code. We will follow the code. The code requires a warning label. We're in an optional narrative here. A generic warning label meets this requirement. A non-enforceable fine print note suggests reading NFPA 70E-2004. The 70E standard gives a range of labels. No information, just a warning. Broad brush information and a warning. Detailed information and a warning. The detailed information section is in appendix to 70E and is non-enforceable within 70E. Do you get the feeling that these super humdinger calculations are a far stretch from the minimal requirements? I think that's a safe conclusion. Now, are they a valid extension? That's something you have to decide for yourself. Consultants and vendors are strongly recommending the purchase of $10,000 software and many hours, even hundreds of hours, of trained person's time to perform the detailed calculations and preparation of detailed warning labels. Their justification is that OSHA went after a major auto manufacturer who let an electrician get killed because of old and defective protective equipment. Your instructor has strong opinions that the workplace should be safe for construction and maintenance persons. An operating safety program with daily work planning sessions and discussion of hazards is essential. No label can deliver this much protection. Generic labels tend to be more readable than detailed labels, and none of the samples offered in several courses on arc flash hazard actually tell the maintenance person what personal protective equipment to put on. A good fix for arc fault problems may increase the hazard to workers and to the plant. Section 110.16. Optional narrative. Arc flash magnitude is determined by the amps available and the milliseconds or seconds for which they are available. An excellent way to limit the milliseconds is to install current limiting fuses. This may not eliminate the arc flash, but will reduce the severity and possibly reduce the level of personal protective equipment required for the worker. The downside, however, is that current limiting fuses do not coordinate well with circuit breakers. A low-level arcing fault, much more common, will burn longer before being cleared. The goal was to reduce high-level arc energy. It worked, but the side effect was to increase low-level arc energy. Access space around electrical equipment. 110.26. Everyone involved in electrical design should study 110.26 and then study it some more. The following is my interpretation. There are at least three concerns which must all be met. One, open space must be reserved for all points on electrical equipment requiring access. The safe number is 42 inches from the edge of the opening to the first piece of equipment, mechanical, electrical, wall, or waste basket where the person might be standing. What we're talking about here is if somebody gets zapped, they've got to be able to step back away from it and get unzapped. And I've been in too many HVAC machine rooms where you're almost forced into the equipment to connect probes. This is not right. 42 inches is the space we want. And again, there's some fine print ways to minimize this and play games. But if you work from 42 inches, that's a good start. If energized equipment is the first piece behind the guy, then the distance must be increased to 48 inches. And for goodness sake, please avoid this. Being surrounded by hazards. When late in the day, after I've been working hard, I get clumsy. And I have to be very, very careful. Having two pieces of energized equipment to keep track of while I'm still trying to do some useful work is too much for me. Don't put your guys in this situation. The requirement does not apply to blank sides or backs without removable panels. And this is one of the reasons that motor control centers have become so popular, because there's a panel on the side for extending it at some later date, and obviously you want to keep some space on the side of it to extend it at a later date, but that's not part of our 42 inches. And electrical panels, where it's just a box. Well, you get at it from the front. You get all the wiring from the front. If you have to do any maintenance, you do it from the front. There's nothing on the side or the back that involves this. The second consideration, 30 inches width must be clear in front of the equipment for access. A power panel or motor starter may not be placed on the back wall of a 24-inch closet. or between a hot water heater and the wall if the space is less than 30 inches. Specifically, swing outdoors must be able to open a full 90 degrees. Once again, we're just trying to make it possible for the maintenance guy to do his job without undertaking an excessive hazard. 3. Dedicated space above and below electrical equipment must be kept clear of other electrical equipment, mechanical equipment, and especially ducts and piping. The space goes to the standing floor for the equipment. The space above goes to 6 feet above the equipment or to the structural ceiling, whichever is lower. A drop ceiling or building structural element is permitted. There is a 6-inch addition for equipment associated with the electrical equipment. That is, a 12-by-12-inch trough can run below a row of 6-inch deep panel boards or starters to feed into them and out of them. Even though it extends beyond the starter, it's less than 6-inch extension beyond the starter. And it's a good installation, and the code recognizes this as a good and acceptable installation. The problem always encounters overhead piping. Mechanical guys are trying to do their job, we know that, but they've got to do their job without putting piping or ducts over top the electrical equipment. It's just forbidden. It's against the law. The inspector's going to notice it. There's going to be rework, and it's going to be real expensive. Better to talk about it beforehand. Optional narrative, there are other code requirements to be able to stand up in the space. That is, you got to have 6.5 feet of headroom in 110.26E, and you've got to be able to see. No automatic lighting controls, 110.26D. Amazing how this rush towards energy conservation has people putting automatic lighting controls everywhere. You don't put them in an electrical room. Code forbids it. Computations which require 43.3 inches clearance in front of 480-volt equipment, 90.9.C.4 and 110.26. Where safety is involved, soft conversions shall be used. Soft conversion is direct mathematical conversion. Now, you've got to understand the National Electric Code uses metric measurements as the primary standard. This is to be consistent with international standards. It's probably a good idea. So, when the code says 1.1 meters, parentheses 3 1/3 feet, you think 3 1/3 feet sounds like, oh, it's got to be 3.5 feet, 42 inches, okay? But 1.1 meter times, I've got it here in centimeters, 110 centimeters times 1 inch divided by 2.54 centimeters equals 43.31 inches, not 42 inches. Some persons experienced with unfriendly inspectors anticipate problems in this area. The change in the 1200 amp 10-foot rule for electric rooms in 110.26. For equipment rated 1200 amps or more containing overcurrent devices, switches, or control, there must be at least one door, 24 inches wide by 78 inch high, at each end. Doors must open outwards and have panic bars and such that are normally latched but open under simple pressure. There is an exception that permits a single door if excess space is provided, but the outward swinging door with panic bar is still required. And if you can anticipate an electrical explosion, you can understand why this is so important. There's always damage to the eyes. We try not to talk about this. We certainly try not to think about this. But arc flash blinds people. And even if it's recoverable, how do you get out when you're blinded? Well, you got to know where the exit is. You got to be able to get out even if you're burned and you're not seeing. Labeling of wire color codes on all panels. This is new, 210.5.C, where more than one nominal voltage system is present in a building, each hot conductor must be identified by color coding, marking tape, tagging, or other means. A legend of the systems and colors used must be posted at each panel. Newer buildings often have both 120-208 and 277-480. Older buildings often have 120-240 and 120-208, or 120-240 and 240-delta. The color coding is a long-standing requirement. The legend sheet on panels is new. If you look at it, it's not a problem. It takes, 15-20 minutes to figure out what the thing should look at, run off 20 or 50 of them on the printer. Then you got to find somebody to go out and stick them onto the panels. If you haven't encountered this wide labeling tape, it's marvelous stuff. It's almost impervious. Yeah, people can go at it with a knife or a screwdriver and destroy it. But in ordinary use, you put a typed legend under a piece of transparent wide tape and it's there forever. The change in grandfathering regarding GFCI receptacles in 210.8.B. 406.3.D.2 is the old section, and it's still valid, which says that any replacement receptacles must be GFCI if a GFCI is required at that location by the present code. This is grandfathering. You leave the old one in place until it fails. When you have to work on it, you put in the new one following the code. This grandfathers old standard receptacles until they must be replaced. 422.51 says that new or remanufactured vending machines after 1105, that's January 1st, 05, behind us, must have integral GFCI or be connected to a GFCI outlet. That says that when a vending machine is installed or replaced, the receptacle behind it may have to be replaced with a GFCI unit. New GFCI requirements for commercial kitchens and outdoor public places, 210.8.B. For non-dwelling locations, again, we're talking commercial locations, industrial, whatever, all 120-volt receptacles in locations 1 through 5 must have ground fault circuit interrupters. 1, bathrooms. 2, commercial and institutional kitchens. 3, rooftops. 4, outdoors in public places. 5, outdoors for maintenance of HVAC equipment. Now, there's two parts to this. There must be receptacles there, and they must be GFCI. The requirement for commercial kitchens is reworded in the 2005 code, but has been in previous versions and largely ignored. There's a lot of leakage currents in kitchens because of good grounding through the piping and a high amount of moisture. Also, refrigeration equipment cycles frequently, and the inrush can trip a GFCI. A dedicated receptacle behind the refrigerator is not excluded from the 2005 requirement. Optional narrative. How to handle this? Well, what can you do when the code says you must install a GFCI and you know the GFCI is going to trip out and if nobody notices, the meat's going to rot? Well, the only thing I know is to tell the owner. And then this isn't going to get you in good stead with your supervisor or the architect. The immediate reaction is, well, we don't need the code. We do need meat that doesn't rot. I'm telling you what the code says. You got to work out your relationships yourself. There will be false trips of appliance receptacles. GFCIs tend to fail completely when they are called on to trip frequently, and it is very likely that refrigerators will trip off. So this section is going to cause a lot of trouble. Outdoors in public places refers to any outdoor receptacle which is in a location acceptable to the general public. Employees, contractors, and visitors need not be protected by this section of the code. The 2008 requirement for bedroom arc fault circuit interrupters, AFCI, in section 210.12.B. The rule applying to construction today is that all 120-volt outlets supplying lights and cord-connected equipment must be protected by an AFCI. Until 1108, this requirement can be met by an AFCI in the panel. The story I hear on this, and I don't claim to be an expert in it at all, that they're having some trouble with these arc fault circuit interrupters. They work better when they're close to the load and close to the fault or the normal switching action of, you know, hair dryers. Hand hair dryers are a big problem. They look like a fault, but they're not a fault. And if when these things are working right, they don't trip out on a hair dryer, but they do trip out on something that's smoldering and going to catch fire. Well, they work better when they're closer to the load. By putting them back in the panel board, there's a lot of wire between here and there. So there's a lot of chance to pick up noise and strange things happen between here and there. If you can have it built into the receptacle in the room, it's a much more reliable safety device. But the code says until January 2008, you put one in the panel for every bedroom. After January 1st, 2008, it must be a receptacle in the bedroom. And outlet in the National Electric Code means lights and cord-connected equipment. Been a lot of hassle on whether lights are outlets. And if you look at the way words are used in the National Electric Code, outlets and lights go together. They are not different. Receptacles and outlets go together, too. The 80% rule, 210.19.A.1. The branch circuit conductor shall have an allowable ampacity not less than 125% the continuous load. Exception, overcurrent device listed for 100% can be applied for 100% of the continuous load. This can be confusing, and I think the way most people address it is by just dropping it completely. Remember the rule and don't worry about why it is. The rule is called the 80% rule. In the special reasoning and language of the code, it's better to say choose the protection for 125% of the load instead of use not more than 80% of the protective device rating. Everyone calls it the 80% rule, even those words do not appear anywhere in the code. Now, the optional narrative in this section says 100% protective devices are available in switchboards and standalone enclosures. Typically, they are high-end circuit breakers with electronic trip units. Note that standalone enclosures are much larger than for standard units and cannot easily be retrofitted. Now, the story I've heard again and again, and I don't know whether I should believe it, I don't know if you should believe it, is that there's something hinky about the temperature response of standard thermal magnetic protective devices, that if you got a bunch of them in a box in operation, which would be a definition of a panel board, box gets hot. Well, I've done maintenance. You go up and you touch it with the back of your hand and the box is hot. You check the breakers, you can tell which ones are energized. You check them with a clamp on to see if they're overloaded, but I mean, that's the way electrical equipment works. Now, the story has been that circuit breakers are really tested in a kind of 70-degree environment, and when they're operating in a higher temperature environment, they're much closer to tripping before you run any current through them at all. So you're only allowed to use 80% of the rating so that you don't get the false trip, so that it's actually operating right. It's a 20-amp breaker, but it's in a high-temperature ambient, so you're only allowed to use 16 amps of this. Now, there's something flaky about that reasoning, too, that, I don't want to pursue. But the exception is, if you have an oversized enclosure and you can keep the temperature down, then you can call it a 100% device and operate it at 100% of its rating. And if you've ever looked at these things, they are noticeably larger enclosures. Breakers don't look the least bit different. They may be. I can't, no x-ray vision here. But the boxes are a lot bigger. So when you say, hey, I'm going to use 100% of my capacity, I'm going to put in a 100% breaker, you can do that. It works. It costs a little more, but it can be a real nice economic solution to a problem, except it takes wall space. And a lot of times the wall space is the deal killer on it. I mean, it looked like a wonderful solution, but not when you have to build more building to accommodate it. Calculate acceptable voltage drop. 210.19, fine print note 4. Warning flag should go up immediately when you hear fine print note. Normally, fine print notes are not enforceable. We'll get to that. Branch circuit voltage drop is limited to 3% to the farthest outlet. Total voltage drop on both feeders and branch circuits to the farthest outlet must not exceed 5%. The quick, clean, and easy solution is to upsize the conductor for distances over 100 feet. That is, classrooms closest and second closest to the panel use number 12 copper, but the third closest classroom gets number 10 copper. And what's going on there? Well, after you do it a while, you find out that 90 feet, 100 feet is about where the break point is, and you never get into trouble if you do that. Now, if you get into one of these positions where somebody is pressing you against the wall, are you meeting voltage drop requirements? There is a table in the written version of this thing that talks about different kinds of loads. Technology receptacles, general purpose receptacles, HVAC rooftop units or heaters, perimeter lighting, and general room lighting. These are different because of the voltage level and because of the neutral. And what does neutral have to do with all this? Well, if we're talking voltage drop on a conventional single phase circuit, you got voltage drop going out and voltage drop coming back. So you've got your source voltage minus the supply drop minus the return drop, and that tells you what you've got out at the load. So it's very critical. Well, I mean, 50% of your drop is in the neutral. A technology receptacle typically is specified with a dedicated neutral. You must have return voltage drop. So you're going to have to upsize the wire much sooner on a technology receptacle than on a general receptacle. On general receptacles with a balanced neutral, and we're going to assume a balanced neutral whether it's there or not. It's kind of a reasonable thing to say because, once again, in a computer classroom, you got all these computers in a row. All the computers run. You know exactly what's going on there. You can specify, if you want 16 amps on your circuit, you can put 16 amps on your circuit and be pretty sure 16 amps is going to flow. You decide it's going to be limited to 8 amps, it's 8 amps because those computers are on and they're on all day. There isn't anything funny going on. General receptacles are not like that. One teacher has a fish tank with a light and a bubbler and maybe a little heater. Another teacher has under the desk kilowatt heater because the teacher gets cold in the middle of the day and has to turn the thing on. You cannot predict what's going to be on general receptacles. So if you're going to make an assumption, let's make an assumption it's balanced, because that's the way we're running it. We're running out three hots and a neutral. We're assuming that the neutral is going to carry one phase back, and anything more than one phase balances it and negates the voltage drop on the receptor, except for harmonics, which we'll talk about down the road, and we don't worry about harmonics for schools. Maybe we should. It's something I've been wondering about. This is an aside of an aside. I've got a friend who just got a new harmonic analyzer, $4,000 toy. Beautiful, and obviously they want him to use it. Well, he happens to be the electrical engineer for a large state university. And I said, I'll take a vacation day, and we'll go over to some of your computer classrooms and see what kind of harmonics you're getting out of those things. I know what the books say. I know what the story is. I'd like to see some measurements. HVAC rooftop heater, what's going on there? Well, it's a typically these are three-phase 240 volt devices. Real hard to get the HVAC guys to go to 480, but on a three-phase 240 volt device with no neutral, there's a section in the table on how to do this. The perimeter lighting, again, with high efficiency lighting in a normal environment. Now, this is not for a high security environment, but a normal environment where you just want some light out there so the cops driving by can see if anybody's in the bushes. Okay, you run a single phase circuit around the edge of the building. It's a long run and there aren't many lights, so you run a single phase 277 volt with a dedicated neutral. You can also run 480 line to line with no neutral. I don't like doing that. I don't know if it's of error or failing on my part. I just don't feel comfortable with it. 277 and a neutral on a safety ground, I feel real good about that. The final one is room lighting, which is three-phase 480 volts, or single-phase 277 with a balanced neutral. Once again, we know the lights are going to be on. We know everybody's going to have their lights on. So in theory, the neutral's balanced, except for harmonics, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And again, we start with number 12 wire, and I've got this big long table, but I put a column in the table just for your personal use, because awful lot of what we do is 20 amp circuits. That's 16 amps available using the 80% rule. So for a number 12 wire using a 20 amp breaker, 60 feet for a dedicated neutral, 130 feet for a balanced neutral, 140 feet and the next one, 150 feet, 300 feet for 277, 480 balance neutral. And again, this goes from 12 down to 10, 8, and 6. And you can see what your choices are for upsizing the ampacity in order to maintain the 3% maximum voltage drop. And by the way, just a secret between you and me, a lot of this stuff is high-intensity discharge lighting, whether it's fluorescent or metal halide, the stuff's got a transformer or a regulator circuit anyhow. It can run 10% low voltage and just be real happy. And an aside of an aside, I've got a commission now from a water plant that failed 80 brand new, very expensive metal halide lamps. That is fixtures, you know, the big $400 fixtures, and the manufacturer said it's bad plant voltage. So I'm going in to verify they don't have a bad plant voltage. It's a new plant. It's got new lighting transformers. They're dedicated for the lighting circuits. When I was in there with my handheld meter, just sat there solid as a rock. No harmonics, nothing funny. I put a logger on, nothing happening. They say, well, it's transients. So I got a transient recorder. We'll see if there's any transients. But once again, metal halide and fluorescent are very forgiving, and in the next course I write, I may have more information on them to share with you. AWG is copper wire size in this table. That's ohms per 1,000 feet from table 9 in the back of the NEC. The first set of data is for a single phase 120 volt circuit with a dedicated neutral, an example being a technology receptacle. The amp feet column permits you to determine the voltage drop for any loading. The FT16A column is the feet permitted for 16 amps, that is a 20 amp circuit breaker. It says that you can go 60 feet before requiring an upsize to number 10. Now, the reason I put this in here, this is the conventional form of this table where you do this amp feet thing and divide by how many amps you have. I dislike that intensely and I recommend strongly against it, even though you know for sure there's only 8 amps on that receptacle when it's installed. You don't know what it's going to be in 2 years or 5 years, 10 years or 20 years, and an awful lot of installations are still in place without being touched 20 years later. So if it's a 20 amp breaker, figure they're 16 amps low. That, I mean, you don't have to do that for totalizing, get a monster huge transformer for your service, but you don't want to have a situation where you've used up all your margins on the first day it's put into service. The second set of data is for a three-phase 208 load or 120 volt loads on a common balanced neutral as a general purpose receptacle or 208 volt heater. That says you can go 130 feet before requiring an upsizing to number 10. Third set of data is for a 240 volt three-phase load as a heater. It says you can go 140 feet before requiring an upsize to number 10. Fourth set of data is for a 277 volt single phase load as perimeter lighting. It says you can go 150 feet before upsizing to number 10. And if you think about this, if you've got a delivery point and you go this way for 150 feet and that way for 150 feet, you've covered a lot of the building. Fifth set of data is for a 277 volt single phase load on a balanced neutral or a 480 volt load. It says you can go 300 feet before requiring an upsize to number 10. And this is one of the reasons why people are switching over almost universally to 277 volt lighting. It's just so economical. I think I just did the calculations on this. Some huge number of fixtures on a single circuit. You're not limited by circuit loading on a circuit. You're limited on how many you want to go out when there's a fault. You don't want everything to go out. You got your night lights, of course, but you'd rather have some people still working when one of the ballasts fails. These calculations are for full capacity use of 16 amps on a 20 amp circuit breaker. For a 12 amp load, you can use the amp foot column or provide spare capacity for change out of the load in the future. These calculated distances are for number 12 AWG copper. They also work for number 10 AWG copper at 24 amps on a 30 amp circuit breaker, or number 8 copper on 32 amps for a 40 amp circuit breaker. Now what we're saying is the thing is scalable. You can use the feet column safely. Optional narrative. This section has been in the code for many revisions. The location in a fine print note makes it unenforceable. Oh my gosh, why did we waste so much time on an unenforceable fine print note? Because exactly the same requirement now appears in ASHRAE 90.86, also called 90.99, also called 90-02, which has been mandated by all of the states. It's become a state requirement when it was unenforceable in the National Electric Code. And I am very, very interested in how the Air Conditioning Society got into a position to mandate electrical energy conservation. Renewable fuses are outlawed for new installations, 240.60.D. Class H renewable cartridge fuses are only permitted for replacement where there's no evidence of overfusing or tampering. The key concept is that oversized one-time fuses can easily be identified by their marking. Oversized renewable fuses can only be identified by disassembling the cartridge and closely examining the elements. Ground detector on floating power systems, 250.21. Several cases are indicated where ungrounded power systems are permitted. A ground detector is required when the voltage is 120 volts or higher. It does not say that the ground detector must trip off power. For years, it was common for 240 volt Delta power systems to have three incandescent lamps at the transformer, each connected from a phase to ground. When leakage current to the ground was well balanced, all three lamps glowed dimly. When a ground fault occurred, the lamp on the affected phase went out. No more voltage there because there's a short. The two others glowed brightly because we've got an offset neutral. I mean, there never was a neutral, but what looked like a neutral got offset to one of the phase levels. Of course, the same result can be obtained with relays or a semiconductor board potted in epoxy. I mean, you can go out and buy one for $35 from several catalogs. I thought the incandescent lights were nice, but boy, it sure has a 1950 look to it. Ground and bond the electric power service entrance, 250.50. This section deserves a lot of argument. You are almost certainly going to want to read the exact wording in the code and see if your instructor is making sense or if he's seeing different words than you're seeing. But what the instructor says is all grounding electrodes described in 1 through 6 that are present must be connected together. Metal underground water pipe, metal frame of the building or structure, concrete encased electrode, ground ring encircling the building, rod or pipe electrodes, plate electrodes. This is being interpreted to mean that you must provide all six in a new structure. The electrical contractor must arrange to lay ground cables during the foundation pour. You've got to have 20 foot of bare copper in the foundation pour. You must install a ground ring. That is, you got to bury some bare conductor, you know, 10 feet out from the structure all the way around. You must install a conventional ground rod, and if it measures above 25 ohms, you must install a plate electrode or another if the first and another if the first measures above 25 ohms. Now, the key to this is, what does the word if present mean? Obviously, if the civil guy comes in and pours his concrete, and you come in later and the concrete's set up, it's not possible to pour concrete over the electrode. Well, it's being interpreted that it's the construction manager's job, it's the architect's job, it's the electrician's job, and maybe even the civil guy's job to make sure that wire's in place and hanging out there when he pours the concrete. There must be a concrete encased electrode if you're pouring concrete. I mean, there's no way around this in my interpretation here. The thing on a water pipe, we've been doing that forever. If there's a metal frame, sure, you do that. The ground ring, some people have been doing that, and I always wondered why. It seemed like a good idea, but I couldn't find any place it was required. Well, this year it's required. If it's present, well, it's present if you're putting up the building. And it's present if somebody has already put in a lightning system. You know, the rod is something we've done for a long time, and plate electrodes. I've always thought that was kind of keen. I couldn't see how they were better than pipe electrodes, and I can't understand for the life of me why they say you should put in an electrode here. I'm sorry, a pipe electrode here and a plate electrode over there. But hey, this is somebody else wrote the code. We're trying to read it and follow it and stay out of trouble. This is interpreted to mean that you must provide all six on a new structure. The electrical contractor must arrange to lay ground cables during the foundation pour. You must install a ground ring, you must install a conventional ground rod, and another if it measures above 25 ohms. You must install a plate electrode, and another if the first measures above 25 ohms. Now, here is something that's... why do we even do this? Well, I guess something about we like electricity, we like electrical construction, so we do things even when they get a little bit, and this is a little bit. Concrete may explode if you ground to foundation rebar steel. And this is quoted against section 100, the definitions on wet location. Previous section requires concrete encased grounds in new construction. Section 100 definition recognizes that the installation in concrete is a wet location. Water content of concrete is what makes it a good grounding conductor. Unfortunately, when water conducts large amounts of electricity, it heats to boiling and expands enormously, and the rapid expansion appears to be an explosion of the concrete. Now, who cares, and what do you do if you do care? Well, the State Department of Transportation cares. They require two grounding connections on each highway light pole. What they're trying to do is split any lightning current in two directions so that they don't put so much stress on the concrete base that it's going through to get out there to where the rod is. Same applies to electric service grounding. Yes, the concrete encased electrode, but also dry some ground rods, bury the ground plate, and install a building perimeter ring. Then you don't get all that current flow through the foundation rebar. I mean, yeah, you get a fraction of it, but hopefully you avoid the explosion, which could be a little bit difficult to repair. Grounding requirements for remote transformers, 250.30.A.4. Where more than one separately derived system, transformer, generator, photovoltaic system, whatever, over 1 kVA is installed, it's okay to run a tap conductor to the common grounding electrode conductor. The common grounding conductor must not be smaller than 3/0 AWG copper. Tap size is sized by section 250.66 based upon the dry system phase current. Optional narrative. Previous revisions have been sticky about running an independent ground conductor from the remote transform back to the system ground. With the current wording, a single ground conductor can wander all over the facility to pick up all the transformers. Splicing the grounding electrode conductor and ground bus, 250.64.C. Splicing of the grounding electrode conductor is permitted by irreversible compression type connectors listed for grounding and bonding. Splicing of the grounding electrode conductors can also be done by exothermic welding. This had been a stickler with inspectors for years and years. And here's the section that says that if done properly, a splice is acceptable on the ground bus. You must ground natural gas indoor piping. 250.104.B. Accessible grounding jumpers must be installed to the building structure and metal piping system, specifically including natural gas systems. Interestingly, 250.52 specifically forbids connecting to external natural gas systems. And if you think about it, think of the guy that's breaking a connection. If he's inside the building, we hope both sides of it are grounded and nothing happens. If he's outside the building, there is no reason to think that the other side is grounded in any way similar to our ground, and we're asking for a spark when he breaks that pipe. So this isn't as arbitrary as it appears. Underground cables may be spliced without a box or enclosure, 300.5.E. Direct buried conductors or cables may be spliced or tapped without the use of splice boxes. There are epoxy kits available for this purpose. Most are REA approved, but UL approved approval is required in order to satisfy the National Electric Code. Provision for settling or heaving for direct buried cables and conduits, 300.5.J. Where direct buried conductors, raceways, or cables are subject to movement by ground settlement or frost heaving, they must be arranged to prevent damage. Some benefit is achieved by an S-loop near the ground exit. Special expansion contraction joints are available, but attention is required to repair the underground electrics when the motion has exceeded the allowance provided by the S-loop or the expansion joint. And it'll be pretty obvious. It looks torn up when it's torn up. Currents do not split equally on multiple conductors per phase, 310.4. Conductors 1 aught AWG or larger may be connected in parallel to increase the power delivered to the load. The code has two restrictions as follows. 1. Size the individual conductors per their normal rating, that is table 310.15.B.2.A. And 2. Equipment grounding conductors, if used, must be placed in each conduit and sized for the total current, not for the parallel segment in that conduit. Many designers and contractors are unhappy that they can split the phase current flow but cannot split the equipment grounding conductor. Optional narrative. What designers, contractors, and code writers don't realize is that currents do not split equally on multiple conductors per phase. Now, let's make sure we're in agreement what we're talking about. We've got a 2000 kVA transformer outside on a pad, and we've got... I'm trying to remember the picture of this because I was actually in that enclosure with a clamp on measuring those currents near the exposed lugs. I did not like being there at all. But I think there were 12,500 MCMs per phase. There was a lot of conductors lugged down to that transformer secondary, all going into the main switchboard. And I got different numbers on each of the phases. Now, I got a lot of them that were uniform, what you'd expect. But I got some low ones, and I got some high ones. Now, actually, I just got one high one. And the high one was pretty near the rating of the conductor. That means that when the plant is running at full tilt, it would be overloaded compared to the temperature rating of the conductor. And we would be asking for a progressive failure of the insulation on the conductor. Now, this is field measurement. This isn't theory or calculations. This is what you get from a clamp-on meter. Now, why would you get a low phase and why would you get a high phase? Well, a lot of people would think it's because they're bent out funny and they, you know, they're in physical contact with something that acts like a closed loop inductor or something like that. I think it was the crimp torque on the ends. If somebody says, we measured this, how do we fix it? I say, take a plant shutdown, open them up, put some conductive paste on each of them, crank them down, crank them to the manufacturer's recommended torque and see what happens. And I would really expect that to solve the problem. Both ends, of course, not just the end out in the yard was nasty, but the end in the switchboard was a lot worse. If you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. We're not going to talk about arc flash suits here, but I'm trying to figure how any contractor can work in the future, because you can't move your arms, you can't move your fingers, and you can't see in an arc flash suit. Yeah, you can bang your head against something that's energized, but how do you get any work done? The remedy successfully applied has been the application of conductive paste and retightening the lugs. And once again, it's to the manufacturer's recommended torque. Problem does not disappear, but diminishes sufficiently that all conductors are operating within their current and temperature ratings. I think it's time to take a break now. Let's come back and do a little more of the National Electric Code. Talking about increasing conductor sizing when routing through industrial ceilings. I bet that's nothing you've encountered previously, but it makes good sense, and we should talk about it. So I hope you come back for the next section.